funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Falls are the most common cause of injuries among senior citizens, and falls are behind 95% of hip fractures. While a hip fracture might not sound like a big deal, for seniors, a broken hip is a moment that changes everything. For patients, families, and caregivers, about half of all seniors hospitalized for a hip fracture cannot return home or live independently after the fall. So what makes a hip fracture so deadly, and what can you do to prevent your loved ones from falling? Today on Think, we'll talk with two caregivers, one professional, and the second a daughter of someone who suffered a broken hip last year. Cheryl Akers is a geriatric care manager and nurse, and Janet Mariani works at Belmont Village Turtle Creek Senior Living in Dallas. Welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Cheryl Akers, let's start with what makes a fall so deadly.
That's a great question. It can be very complicated because you have to look at the reason for the fall. Did the fall occur because a senior fell and tripped over something? Or in some schools of thought, the hip has fractured and then the person has fallen. So, you know, what are all the circumstances around the actual fall? Are they not eating and drinking well enough? Are they losing some mobility, so therefore they've lost muscle strength? So there's many, many factors that go into it. And unfortunately, as you mentioned, it's extremely devastating not only for that person but their family and their loved ones. To prevent falls, that's a challenge because, again, it goes back to who is this person, what is wrong with them as far as medical conditions, what are their functional abilities?
But are a lot of the people who fall, is it the underlying conditions that they have, problems, other medical issues that makes the fall sort of not just a trigger but something that really puts it over the edge?
It could be. You know, for people over the age of 65, most of them are on at least 5 medications. So sometimes there's medication issues. And if there's medication involved, they're being treated for some kind of medical condition. There's a lot of people that have high blood pressure, thyroid problems. They may have high cholesterol, some degree of heart disease. So with those conditions alone, those affect all the rest of your body, your liver function, your kidney function, your brain function, your cardiac function. And so when you have a fall, it's trauma. And then it kind of knocks those other systems out of whack. You know, if you think of a domino, you know, when you line up dominoes, you tip one over and then it knocks into the next one. Then it knocks into the next one. And that's what happens in the seniors. And they don't recover from any kind of traumatic event as well as, say, a 30-year-old. And if they have to have surgery for repairing the fractured hip, the drugs for the anesthesia, for the pain medicine and all of that can have a devastating effect on the body. I mean, an 80-year-old liver does not function the same way as a 30-year-old liver, same as the kidneys.
So the statistic is, and I read it, is that one of every 5 people who breaks a hip after the age of 50 dies within a year. And now, Janet, Mariani, you had this reality sort of driven home to you when your mom fell last year. And I talked to her about how she fell after switching off the light and tripping over a chair.
And so there I was, laying on the floor, pulled down one of my pillows. So I just pulled it down and put my head down on it and thought, well, I'll wait until morning and ask for help. Which I did.
Janet, that's your mom there, Jeanette, talking in November after her hip replacement when she was still recovering. What did you think would happen after the surgery?
Well, hi. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
And it was also nice to hear my mother's voice. Still makes me crack up. Anyway, as soon as my mom fell, and believe it or not, this also happened with my father, which we've never talked about, passed away 5-6 years ago now, I recognized the loss of energy. I just right away understood that she just was not really focusing and taking care of where her feet were. And just losing the energy from, you know, her physical ailments as well. It's so important to put your heel down first, to really pay attention to what's in your surrounding area, and just really be mindful of moving the body, which we all so take for granted and don't even think about, let alone there's also that chance that, in my case, this was present from medication, is that memory loss. And people just aren't moving the same way and remembering because they cannot. And so it's just, and I've noticed this with my seniors that I take care of. They just move so fast. They won't think. They won't just kind of get up slowly, kind of take a stock of what's around them in their immediate area and just kind of settle themselves before walking forward. You know, we see something over on a table to go get, and we just go get it. And they do too. And unfortunately, the rest of their body might not catch up with them. They just move so fast.
Which is funny because you don't often think of old people moving so fast, but even a fast movement for them without seeing a cable on the floor or something else that you might recover from after a trip, it's a lot harder to find that balance, perhaps when all your senses are not you know, like they were when you're 20 or 30. And Janet, just a month after your mom broke her hip, she died on Christmas Day.
Right.
And you had all your family here. You have a big family. What was that? Did it feel like something happened faster than you expected, or were you not surprised about the time?
Believe it or not, I wasn't surprised at all. I really, when she fell, I called up my seven brothers and sisters and said, you've got to get into town if you want to see Mom. I mean, I just knew as a second sense. You know, when you're around seniors as much as I've been last 10 years, day in, day out, you recognize signs and you see that energy loss and you just have that knowing that things aren't right. And I really had that attitude that I knew that she was on her last few months. So my family, you know, is just so adoring and caretaking. And just we all came in, all assembled in the town one by one, just be able to spend time with her and see her in a good place. Time was left.
Now, Cheryl, you see people who have broken, fractured hips. What chances are there for recovery, or what do you say to people when this has happened to them and their families?
Well, there's a lot to be said. And again, it all goes back to who is this person that has fallen and fractured their hip? How functional? Were they out playing golf? Because there's a lot of people that are out playing golf at 80 and 85, playing tennis. And then there's 80-year-olds or 75-year-olds that are sitting on the sofa with a remote control or recliner, remote control, having a very sedentary lifestyle. And, you know, if you had that sedentary lifestyle, a lot of times you will have some other comorbidities or those other illnesses. So you have to look at, yes, this person has fallen and broken their hip. They usually will require surgery. There's not too many broken hips that don't require surgery. So you have to look at the immediate kind of clinical picture and get an understanding from the physicians. How is this person doing from the rest of their body standpoint? Mm-hmm. Yes, you've put the screws and the plates and the nails in place and so that the carpentry work itself has been done. But how's the rest of the body functioning? A lot of times, as Janet mentioned, there can be memory problems, and really, a lot of times there's some underlying dementia, but people have been able to function. And with the anesthesia, the trauma, the pain medications, that pushes that dementia over the edge, so it becomes much more apparent. And people go, oh my goodness, look at Mom or Dad. And we didn't know this was a problem. And, you know, so to prepare somebody for that, you have to kind of play all the case scenarios. You have to say, you know, look, your mom or dad may need rehab after the immediate post-operative phase is over, but we also have to consider, are they going to be able to return back home again? all that will depend on how the rehab goes. So you kind of you start developing an algorithm. We say, okay, well, if rehab goes well, we may be able to go home. Rehab doesn't go so well, we may have to go to assisted living. Assisted living, they get more therapy through home health. They get better. They may go back home again. Maybe they don't. So you kind of paint, here's all the potential case scenarios. And I would love to be able to predict and say, here we are. This is what's going to happen. Boom, boom, boom. Not so much. But I can say, here's the potential for this, that, and the other thing. But here's what we really need to watch for, because your mom or dad has this problem, had that problem. And just, you know, truly be the clinician and say, as a nurse, look, you know, if the kidneys aren't working so well, we need to keep an eye on that. And do we need to do as many drugs or the higher doses of the drugs? Because unfortunately, elder bodies, again, aren't the same, but yet healthcare professionals tend to treat, well, they're an adult, so therefore we'll give them the same amount of drugs as we do a 40-year-old. I think we're getting better at saying we may need to taper the doses down. We may need to cut the doses so they're better able to handle them.
Now, you talk about that decision and that diagram of going from, okay, what's next after rehab? We have to figure out how well are they going to recover? What's this mean about returning home? Many people don't return home. Some people
right.
do.
Right.
And there comes that decision of assisted living, nursing homes. In the series The Broken Hip on KERA, we heard from one person, Earl Schmaltz, and his daughter, Barb, about the difficulties of caring for someone when they're after a broken hip, put in assisted living or a nursing home, and their family is long distance.
My preference was to go home, at which point I was told I can't go home until I find somebody that would be with me on a 24-hour basis. All my kids live out of town, so I don't have anybody locally that I want living with me. Just wouldn't be comfortable.
You know, I know he does want to go home, and I'm very torn about that, but he can't. So what is it? It just tears you up, kind of. I don't know how I do it. It's expensive. It's just hard. It's like several different lives that you're running.
There are around 7 million long-distance caregivers like Barb in the U.S., and increasingly they're turning to geriatric care managers like yourself, Cheryl. Describe what that is in just a minute.
In just a minute. Well, I tell people I'm almost like a surrogate daughter, a surrogate son, being the eyes and the ears and hopefully coordinating, facilitating, and advocating for the senior. Because, you know, most every time the adult children get put in the position of making decisions when there's a traumatic event for that senior, sometimes the kids have not had that discussion of what would their parents want? What do their parents need? What kind of money is there? There's all kinds of moving pieces and parts that are involved. As a geriatric care manager, we take a look at the whole picture saying, okay, what's going on? What are the problems? How can we develop some solutions? And who's going to pay for them? Because unfortunately, care is not free, period. And health insurance, i.e. Medicare or any other type of health insurance, does not pay for long-term or custodial type of care. So the care managers are very good at identifying funding options and or coming up with creative ideas. Maybe somebody doesn't need to be in a nursing home. Maybe they just need some care in assisted living short term, go home and have some care brought into the home. So, you know, what we do is try to be very neutral and objective, because the adult children, you know, they say to me, well, how do you know what you don't know? So we're there to educate them on what their options are.
We're talking today with Cheryl Akers and Janet Mariani about caregiving and KERA's series, The Broken Hip. You can check out our digital storytelling project at kera.org/thebrokenhip. And join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman in today for Chris Boyd. Our guests are Cheryl Akers and Janet Mariani. Both of them have been caregivers, and Cheryl professionally as a nurse and geriatric care manager, Janet as a daughter. Both are also featured in KERA's digital storytelling project, The Broken Hip. Janet, when your mom fell and broke her hip last year, you had to navigate the world of surgery and rehab and decisions about what to do after the fall. What was that like, and where did you begin?
Oh, well, obviously you have to take stock of what you need, what your needs are, you know, and what was so important for my mother after she got her pin put in place was not to lay in the bed. We have to get up. We have to be walking around. You don't want to atrophy and just lay there and get worse. And then you're bedridden. And that is the worst.
I mean, pneumonia
just,
and all
you
of
don't
the other
want to go
effects
into
that,
bedridden yeah. and have two partner assist and everything else. So you really have to make sure anyone who falls gets good rehab. And so you look around at choices. There's always choices, especially living here in Dallas. And you look for good rehab care, and also take into effect the age of the person. So I wasn't going to put my mother on some Olympic track, but she did need to get up, get going, move around, and be able to take care of herself again. And so the fear and the care and concern and the kindness, all those factors come into play to surround your loved one with just that kind of personality that will fit. And you just do that by going and visiting. Hmm. So that's what we did, and we chose a place. And she got great care. Of course, we were there all the time. And just, you know, watching her progress and making sure that she could get up.
Cheryl, when you're working with families and something happens, an event like falling and fracturing a hip, and you're making the decision after rehab about what to do next, how does that negotiation play out when sometimes family members can want such different things? The person who's fallen, who's broken a hip, might want one thing. They might want to return home. The children who are now sort of acting like parents mm-hmm. with their own mother or father mm-hmm. May want something else. What does it feel like to be the middleman, and how do you try and figure out what's actually best?
Well, to start with, if somebody's in rehab, which is usually off, you know, probably 95% of the time, people are going to rehab, whether it's skilled rehab or acute rehab. But somebody that's older is usually going to go to a regular skilled nursing rehab level. Usually within the first 2 weeks, they do an interdisciplinary conference. In other words, they meet with physical, occupational therapy, nursing, the team that's caring for that person. And we look at where was this person before the fracture? How are they doing now? We take into consideration, what does that person want? And the majority all say, I want to go home. I want to go home. I mean, that's the resounding refrain. But in reality, we have to say, can you go home? Can you go home? Depends on when I've started working with this person. I may have been in the home already, and I've identified potential environmental or physical barriers for that person to be going home. Because if that person is not ever going to ambulate again, they are going to be using a wheelchair, and there's two stairs yeah. up into the home. How can they get in, and how can they get out? Most doorways are not wide enough to accommodate, a wheelchair, especially in an older home. I've seen a doorway that's 22 inches wide to get into the bathroom. So you knew that person couldn't get in the bathroom. So we have to take a look at the environmental issues, but how is that person doing? And as they progress through their rehab stay and get stronger, they're able to walk farther, we look at a discharge planning conference at some point, or I ask for one. If the facility hasn't, I'm going, when are we doing a discharge planning conference? We need to get some ducks in a row here, people, because we need to figure out, where is this person truly going to go? Because the picture may have changed greatly from the time they walked in or literally were brought in the door for rehab to where they are now. They may be up and getting along just fine with a walker. They may not. I don't know. So we take a look at that and have the family involved in that conference, so that if child – adult child A and adult child B have differing requests. Oh, I want mom to go home. Well, the other one says, well, I want mom to come live at my house. Well, what does your house look like, you know? So yeah. We kind of have to play everybody against the middle, but it's not so much me saying what can be done. Often it's the therapy team that's saying, look, you know, let's give a dose of reality because, again, you have to look at, was there some dementia that got identified after the fall? Maybe not. Okay. But if they're not walking, you know, it changes the whole perspective. And if you start looking at doing any kind of home modifications, that takes a while.
And can be expensive, yeah. Now, Janet, what are some of the benefits and drawbacks of making that decision to go into an assisted living or a nursing home? You work at a facility that's here in Dallas, so you are very familiar with what's available, what can be helpful, and what sometimes people are afraid to give up.
Right. Well, I'm just a huge advocate for living in community. I happen to work at a gorgeous new community here, Belmont Village. And while there are very many lovely communities here in town, it is to a person that I listen to after they come in after about 6 weeks, they will always say to me, what took me so long? What took me so long to get here? Because it took the scary out of really what it is. What it is a lovely community filled with people, like-minded, great, a beautiful peer group who really looks out for you, becomes an extended family. You know, we're getting older and so many friends have, died. And there are instant friends, instant people to have lunch and dinner and snacks and outings with. And they don't realize, some people just don't realize how much work it is just to call a friend and to get together. And here you are having the friends there, the meals cooked for you, lovely people around. You can stay in your room if you want to. And remember, you've brought your prettiest possessions. So all of a sudden your room looks like home, looks like the room you stayed the most in. And there's a lot of advantages. We take everyone to their doctor's appointments and outings. So they don't have to worry about transportation. They don't have to worry about their food. And they're really there just to enjoy themselves, have fun, and get the exercise and the stimulation that really is lacking living by yourself in home.
Hmm. Now, let's go to the phones now. We have a caller from Fort Worth, Parham. His grandma recovered, I believe, from a broken hip. Parham, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Now, tell us a little bit about what happened with your grandma. Is this recent?
Okay, so this happened when she was 80 years old, and she's 85 now. And like your other, the doctor on the phone was saying about this comorbidity that happened, my grandma has osteoporosis.
Yes.
So it really increases the chances of any kind of fracture. So what she was doing was picking mints from our mint garden, bending over. Then she fell and broke her hip.
Wow. I hope that the mint tea or whatever she was cooking up was something that you'd enjoy. But you said she recovered. So how is she doing now?
She's walking and picking mints again. She got surgery for the hip fracture. She had physical rehab for about 3 months. And then we brought her home. We were like, we're going to continue this physical rehab at home. And so we live in a nice little gated community in Fort Worth, and so she could walk around the community. So that was her rehab. She had to walk every day. We made her walk every day, and she wanted to because she knew that because she had friends her own age that died because of a hip fracture. So she knew the odds. She knew that she could die in a year. So that motivated her to even want to recover faster. So we brought her home, and she would just walk around our community every day, as slow as she could walk. And then every day got a little bit faster and faster, and now she's walking normal speed, and she actually turned 85 2 weeks ago.
Well, congratulations. That's such a nice story to hear. Thank you, Parham. And now, Cheryl, that sounds like something that there's a lot of interaction between, you know, the mother and the son there,
right,
that can be really helpful. What happens when family isn't around?
Anybody recovering from any kind of trauma or surgery, it the attitude is 9/10 of the game a lot of times. I've seen a lot of medical issues that have come up. And, you know, family is super, super important. Or whatever your support system looks like. Because sometimes family is not necessarily a blood relative. Family could be the best friends in the world, and they're there. So that the recovery process is very, very good. With Parham's mother, it sounds like – or his grandmother, I guess. It sounded like –
it was his grandmother.
She was pretty active in the first place. If she was out picking mint in the garden and fell, she was probably out there doing a lot more anyway. So, I mean, that bodes well for her and obviously has. But, yeah, the recovery process, the support system that you have, whatever that support system looks like, is huge for any of us.
And now, if you are looking and you're not in the same state, like some of the people we've talked to in the series, to hire someone to help, how do you know who to hire? How do you know who to trust?
Good question. Well, the thing is, what kind of help are you looking for? Are you looking for like a caregiver that mm-hmm. can come into the home and help somebody with their getting their bath and getting dressed and meal preparation? Or are you talking about the help that I provide? Because when I'm involved as a geriatric care manager, I help figure out what type of services would be beneficial for that particular person at this point in time. Because, again, services are not always permanent. They could be, here we are for now. Let's get through this next few weeks or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I, like a lot of the other geriatric care managers, we kind of have a short list of who we know that we would trust, and we make referrals. We usually all make referrals to more than one provider, and we tell the families, hey, you need to interview this particular company, that particular company, so you get a sense of who they are and the services that they offer. They're all going to be fairly similar. I have a tendency to stay away from private caregivers, because if you hire Jane Doe, who's the sister of somebody's friend, then the senior becomes the employer, and there could be tax ramifications and all kinds of absolutely not good stuff. And you've only got one person. If that person's sick, car's broken down, then you're stuck with nobody. So I always recommend for private caregivers, you go with an agency. Home health agencies are going to provide different services that are paid for under health insurance or Medicare, and they're usually going to be short-term, and they're going in to complete the task, do the therapy, they leave. The private caregivers, the personal care agencies, they're in for 2 to 4 or more hour blocks. It could be there for 24/7, even having a live-in person there. So it's two different levels of what we call home care. One's home health and one's non-medical home care. So, yeah, you have to, you know, it's like anything, buyer beware. You have to figure out who's good, who's licensed, who's bonded, what kind of contracts do they have, what are their costs like, who
now,
are they?
And typically, I mean, Janet, you come from a big family, so you were able to be there. Your sister also, I believe, lives in Dallas too.
Right.
You were able to really be there with your mom. How did that work in terms of juggling job and caregiving and social life and all of the other aspects?
Right. Well, my mom, we had her move into a community, and also we hired extra support. Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's even with you living in Dallas.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. So we got my mom whatever she needed. I mean, the family just came together, and that's the way we operated with both my parents. However, you know, you just, like Cheryl said, you have to just assess what your person needs and just bring those different things to them. And we did. And there's plenty of caretakers too with the professional agencies that you can get to help out in areas when you can't be there. And then after work, you know, days off, weekends, we took over, of course, but and could always supplement. But at least there is someone there because that's the need. So
now, we're going to go to someone on the phones here, Patty, who is in Dallas. And Patty, can you hear me? Are you there?
Yeah.
Hi. So what are you calling in to talk about?
Well, my mom passed away 2 years ago. But she fell over a throw rug, so I'll tell everybody, don't mm-hmm. have throw rugs in the house. Mm-hmm. And she was a tough woman. She was a nurse at the jail.
Mm.
And I took care of her for 4 years, and through that, laying in bed, but getting exercise, she did have a walker. She just started having TIAs. Mm-hmm. So it got to the point where she couldn't walk at all. She had no energy, and she could barely feed herself. So after 4 years, I was getting real sick. I was hurting my back. I was working.
It sounds like that was
really
very
well,
difficult.
No. So I put her in a nursing home the last 2 years of her life.
Ugh.
And it was just two blocks away. But she felt like I abandoned her. And every morning and every night, I'd stop and see her. But the only way to get her into the nursing home the last 2 years is that the doctor had to say that she had a congenital heart, which she did. Yeah. And she just went downhill after that. But I networked in my neighborhood. I had an agency working for me. But my mama saved. She was so good at with money, and she saved so much money to give us. But it needed to be for her. So luckily, I could pay the agency every week. But
Patty, we have a break coming up. I'm so sorry, but I want to return to that. We'll get back to the subject after the break. We're talking today with Cheryl Akers and Janet Mariani about caregiving and KERA's series, The Broken Hip. Check out our digital storytelling project at kera.org/thebrokenhip and join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guests are two caregivers, one professional and the second a daughter of someone who suffered a broken hip last year. Cheryl Akers is a geriatric care manager and nurse. Janet Mariani works at Belmont Village Turtle Creek Senior Living in Dallas. Welcome both of you again to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, more than we were just hearing before the break from someone here in Dallas named Patty who said that there was both physical and, of course, emotional ramifications of trying to care for someone after an event, a traumatic event like breaking a hip. What are some of the challenges that you see with caregivers emotionally?
A lot of burnout.
Cheryl, yeah.
Emotionally, I mean, I see that a lot of times the adult children, they want to do right by their parents. The parents are saying, don't ever put me in a nursing home. That's usually most people saying all that anyway. So the kids are trying to figure out how to keep them out of a nursing home if there are recovery issues that they may not ever recover from. And the kids are often, they're taking time off work. They're using vacation days. They're using Family Medical Leave Act if they work for an employer that's large enough and all that good stuff. They may be using some of their own funds to help pay for services for the parent because the parent may not have long-term care insurance. They may have gone through savings or they may not qualify for any other resources that are out there for funding issues. One of the things that some people don't realize is that funding can be obtained through life insurance policies. People stop paying on them and that money is lost, unfortunately. But yeah, life insurance policies can be a really good source of funding. But the emotional issues are now what do we do? And it's just very, very hard to look at your parent who's no longer acting really like your parent. It's the role, that whole role reversal comes into play. You now become the parent and the parent becomes the child, which can be a little bit off-putting for some because parents are going, I'm fine, I can do all this. And they resent the kids taking over, but yet the parent's no longer really able to take over. And so you get this sometimes tug of war between decision-making and then the physical caregiving issues, the emotional toll of watching their parent and loved one decline. And then also sometimes there's discord among the children. If the, you live there, you get to take care of mom and I'm over in, you know, three states over. With Janet's family, obviously that didn't happen, but that's not an uncommon thing. So you get emotional tug of war too between discordant adult children that either are all in the same area or they're separated or...
Yeah. How did you make that decision, Janet, with having seven other siblings living in different places? Who did the responsibility of caregiving fall on?
Right. Well, thanks for asking me. That's an excellent question because we did solve that back when we were caring for my father. Mm. And it's something for every family to really think about. And so how we solved it was wherever the parent is, in what city, appoint that person. That child then is responsible for their care. And then everyone else rallies around and supports that person. So in the case of my parents, when my mom was in New York City getting some care at one time, my other sister, Jean, was in charge of her medical care. So we allowed her.
And they
that freedom.
And she knew I am the point person.
Yes, she's the point person. It was
designation.
A clear designation. We all supported her emotionally, financially, whatever we needed to do. But we didn't sit there and contradict her decisions. And that is so important for a family to just appoint one person. Let that person be in charge. Let them do what they have to do to care for mom as long as it's, you know, appropriate and right and certainly no abuse and anything like that. Yeah. Just let them handle it because that gives that person such freedom to make those decisions and, of course, have the appropriate power of attorney, financial power of attorney, medical power of attorney, have all those key instruments in place. And look now in your 40s, 50s, 60s, especially 50s, 60s at these instruments because you never know if you're going to have an accident. Your own children or family members need to have those instruments for you. And please, please, please look at long-term care insurance. There are too many great policies that do not cost that much money and will be able to take care of you in your older years so that you won't be a burden to your children and that you're giving back in that way is an excellent thing to look into, you know.
I also want to talk a little bit about some of the ways to prevent falls at home because there are things you can do to make a fall less likely. And I don't know if – I know you, Janet, you went through your mother's house.
Absolutely. You have to look at their shoes, number one. Look at their gait. Really get that assessed. See how they're walking, what you can do there for therapy. Make sure that they're wearing the proper kind of shoes. Look at the rug. Are there loose rugs? Get rid of them. How's the weave on the carpet they have or the slipperiness of the floor? Just all the fall risk, you know, getting into the shower. Make sure those grab bars are around the toilet area. Grab bar in the shower.
What else do you look for, Cheryl, when you're assessing homes and walking in? And you do more. You look at also making lists of medications.
Oh, yeah. There's so many safety issues. It's hard to address them all. But, yeah, the thing about throw rugs, I say the throw rugs are called that because they're meant to be thrown out, especially if there's somebody over the 70 or 80, 75 range. Corners of carpets are also a bad thing, you know, because they will turn up over time. Extension cords, even small dogs or even large dogs, because they can jump up or somebody can be tripped over. Are there night lights in the home? Are there night lights that are on in the bathroom at night? fire extinguishers? Are there handrails that are functional and good up and down the stairs to leave and, you know, enter and leave the home? Because sometimes they're pretty rickety. You know, it just goes on. Is the hot water too hot? Because if somebody's diabetic, their nerve function may be damaged. They can't sense the temperature the same way. And they could easily have a second degree burn on their feet if the water's too hot, if they're soaking their feet. Older people get colder. Their body temperature drops. There's less subcutaneous fat. I know we all want less subcutaneous fat, but unfortunately with seniors, a lot of times their metabolism slows down, there's less fat, and so therefore they are cold. So the air temperature may be higher. And
all of that can affect
Affect that. And then they're wearing a lap rug because their feet are cold, and then they trip over the lap rug trying to get up.
Now, getting over a fear of falling is also important. It turns out, which I learned doing research for this, that people who are afraid of falling are actually more likely to fall. And in our series, we profiled a unique class for fall prevention at the University of Texas at Arlington. Here's a clip from that piece where the kinesiologist Chris Ray demonstrates some of the technology they're using to help people get over their fear of falling.
We line them up appropriately on this force plate.
Dr. Ray is standing in what looks like a photo booth, except there's no seat. You stand on a square metal plate that looks like a bathroom scale. The walls shift, images flash on a screen in front of you, the floor tilts. Think of it as something you might find in a carnival funhouse, only with sensors to record your balance and stability.
In daily life, when we see seniors that fall, it's usually during multitasking. And so what we'll do in here is we'll recreate that. So we can either pipe in loud noises, city sounds, or music. We can pipe in visual distractors on the screen, or we can even have them take like an IQ-type test or a distractive type test on the screen as they're trying to maintain their postural control, potentially with the walls moving and everything kind of moving in concert.
When I was there, Dr. Ray explained the goal is not to make you dizzy or upset, but to identify what makes someone unsteady and then select the best physical exercises to help improve those weaknesses. Are there exercises that you've seen that are helpful, Cheryl, for preventing falls?
Well, in order to rise from a seated position, just getting up from a chair, we use those large muscles in our thighs. Those are what make us get up and down safely. I mean, there's all kinds of exercises that you can do to strengthen those quads as well as your glutes, the ones behind us, because those are huge. One of the issues that comes up, though, too, with falls in the elderly, they may be on medications to get rid of fluid, a diuretic or a fluid pill. So what happens is that works and they get a little bit dehydrated. But on the flip side, then they don't drink enough fluid to make up for that deficit. And so as you and I and everybody else, as we stand up, we get our pressure drops a little bit. So if you take a fluid medication, your pressure drops maybe a little bit more. So they stand up. And as Janet mentioned earlier, people have a tendency to stand up and go instead of standing up, take a deep breath and then go. So you've got those factors in there as well as the strength issues. But, you know, I think a lot of seniors all know somebody that has fallen. Oh, well, I heard about Mary Sue, or they know of somebody that knew of somebody that fell. So there's that element there. And then they've seen the long-term sequelae or what has happened to those people. So, but if that person themselves has fallen once, they're more fearful of falling again, which makes them less mobile. So they tend not to move more as much as they could or should, and therefore they become weaker. So it's very counterproductive by sitting there for more prolonged periods. And then at the same time, they don't want to get up to go to the bathroom, so they drink even less fluids. And sense of thirst decreases as we age and with medications. So you get all of these things working in a very negative way that can make somebody fall. And if they're on the blood pressure medicine along with that fluid pill, the blood pressure medicine may have a fluid medication in it, but the blood pressure medicine may work too well. And blood pressures need to be almost a little bit higher than yours or mine in seniors because they need to get the blood up to their brains. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, exercise is huge. It's huge.
And also, if you need a walker, if you need a cane, use it. I mean, there is
you see a
nothing,
lot of people who do
absolutely. I mean, it's like an anathema to them that they don't want to use a walker or a cane, and if you need it for balance until you're stronger, there's nothing wrong with it, and or an alert button to put it on, even underneath your clothes, so that you have it there mm-hmm. in case you do fall and no one's around.
There's a sense of pride. I always give my lecture of, well, if you don't want to use your walker because you don't want people seeing you use that walker, how would you feel with them seeing you on the ground? What would you rather? And have them pick and make a choice, because when I present it like that, it makes them go, that's right, because I could fall. And a cane is good for only minimal balance issues, because it only works on one side. A walker's much better. And besides, they have really cute bags and things for walkers now. You can throw all your stuff in them.
Accessorize.
Yes.
It's no longer just the tennis balls on the walker bottoms, which I remember my grandfather used.
A lot of people do. I carry tennis balls in my car just for that reason.
Yes. Now, Janet, you work in a senior living facility. What kind of steps do they take there for fall prevention?
Oh, well, we have a wonderful rehab in our community as well, and a beautiful indoor saltwater pool.
Oh, really? A saltwater pool?
Saltwater pool. And so it's so gentle and kind on your skin versus the chlorine. And so we have aerobics, we have yoga, we have tai chi, we have Pilates, let alone we have someone to assess you if you need better strength training and anything that you can use in rehab. We have right there in the community daily.
Now, Cheryl, when is the right time to start talking to your parents about falls and preventing falls?
Yesterday, quite simply. Because the thing is, a fall can happen at any time. I mean, all of us have fallen somewhere along the way. We've tripped over a curb. We didn't see the speed bump. I mean, the fall is just one piece of it. And I always like to say, you need to play the what if game instead of what now. You have to say, well, what if this were to happen, mom or dad? If you fell and broke your hip, how would you like to handle this? What would you like to do? What are your wishes? What if you were in a car accident? Not even a fall question, but you had multiple trauma. You broke several bones. You had a who knows what kind of injuries. What if this were to happen? And it's kind of doomsday saying, but people don't want to talk about it because the parents become afraid of giving up control. But this is a way for them to keep control by making their wishes known, not putting the kids in a position of going, I hope I'm making the right decision. We never had the conversation with mom or dad. So you've got it, because you don't want to have to make that decision in the midst of a crisis and make the wrong decision and look back and go, oh my heavens, what have we done now?
Our guests today, Cheryl Akers and Janet Mariani, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can also check out KERA's digital storytelling project at kera.org/thebrokenhip. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knabe. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.